Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Mesner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Melina, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's program, Update on Lymphoma Treatment, from the 2010 American Society of Clinical Oncology, ASCO, Annual Meeting. It's a very important call. It's one that I know many of you have been waiting to hear all of this new information that has emerged from the meeting itself. Today's program is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and we have a number of other collaborating organizations as well. And it's because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today, there are lots of you, over 1,200 participants from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities. You come from suburban areas, as well as rural and frontier communities. We also have international participants from Africa, Australia, Canada, Egypt, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Singapore, the United Kingdom, and the United Arab Emirates. So we have people from all over the world, and it really is a tribute to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline that our speakers will be covering, information about all the different collaborating organizations, and an evaluation form. And I would ask you to take a moment and complete the evaluation form at the end of today's program. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you would like us to offer in future programs and going forth? And indeed, we really welcome your feedback. Today's program, the topic for today's program, is one that many of you have been requesting, and therefore we offered the program. So do tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to offer it. Now, today's program is supported through unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Cephalon Oncology, Genentech Biogen IDEC, and Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company. And we really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today. I want to start by introducing our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Leo Gordon. He's professor of medicine, director of lymphoma program, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. And Dr. Gordon is going to address brief overview of lymphoma, current treatment options, and how research influences treatment options. Dr. Gordon?
Thank you, Dr. Mesner. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to try to review with you, if I can, the next 15 minutes, lymphoma briefly, talk a little bit about treatment options, and talk about, interspersed in the discussion, how research influences those treatment options. So first of all, non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, and now we know Hodgkin's lymphoma also, are malignancies of the lymphatic system. The lymphatic system is involved in the body's immune function, and it's made up of different types of cells. Lymphocytes are a major component, and it's made up of lymphoid organs. Lymph nodes, the spleen, the liver, and the bone marrow are lymph node organs. The lymphomas can occur in any one of those or a number of those sites. So they tend to arise from lymph nodes. They may arise in the spleen. They may arise in the bone marrow. And they may involve one or many of those sites. So included also in those sites are areas in the gastrointestinal tract and in the respiratory tract. There are lymph nodes there as well. In addition, lymphomas may arise from the thymus gland, which is a special gland in the chest, where some lymphocytes, especially the so-called T lymphocytes, are able to mature and develop. We know that at least in the U.S., we expect about 60,000 cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma per year and about 8,000 cases of Hodgkin's lymphoma per year. If we look at the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, of those 60,000 cases, we expect that anywhere from about maybe 94 to 97% of those are B-cell lymphomas, or what we call B-cell lymphomas, by far the most common type, and then maybe 3 or 4% are T-cell lymphoma, so much more rare. Within the group of the B-cell lymphomas, we can kind of divide, there probably may be 30 different types of B-cell lymphomas, but we can divide them into two major types. One, the aggressive type lymphomas, and two, the non-aggressive or indolent lymphomas. And the most common version of the aggressive lymphoma is something we call diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and the most common version of the non-aggressive lymphoma is something we call follicular lymphoma. And when we talk about research and we talk about treatment, although there are many more to talk about, we're going to sort of refer to aggressive lymphomas and indolent lymphomas and try and make a dichotomy or a distinction between those. The major underlying theme between those is that the diffuse large cell lymphomas are aggressive, and they're treated aggressively with the aim of trying to get rid of the disease with the first round of treatment, the first course of treatment. The non-aggressive lymphomas or follicular lymphomas are more indolent. Sometimes they don't require treatment at all, and they tend to be more chronic diseases. They tend to have a course where they tend to get treated, respond, and then perhaps they may relapse again, but then they can be treated again. So a little different natural history between those two types of lymphomas. When we evaluate patients with a new diagnosis of either the aggressive lymphomas or the indolent lymphomas, we talk about staging, and the staging is based on the location of the lymph node within the body. So stage one disease refers to a localized area of lymph nodes, say, for example, in the neck or under the arm. That's the only site. That would be stage one. Stage two is if you have two or more lymph nodes near each other on the same side of the diaphragm. So, for example, it might be the neck or under the arm, or it might be below the diaphragm. It might be in the groin or in the abdomen. But stage two means that the nodes are involved are on the same side of the diaphragm. Stage three talks about two or more lymph nodes in different parts of the body above and below the diaphragm. So, for example, in the neck or in the groin area, that would be an example of stage three disease. And stage four disease implies that the disease has involving the bone marrow or may involve the liver or may involve, for example, the lung. And one caveat that I would make to this is that unlike in other malignancies, say breast tumors or lung tumors or colon tumors, finding stage four disease is not necessarily a bad sign. We know that in the low-grade lymphomas, 70% of patients may have bone marrow involvement, so there may be stage four. So I wouldn't put nearly as much influence or importance on the designation of the stage in the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas in terms of predicting outcome or predicting prognosis. The other important factor that we've learned about the development of the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, and we don't know the cause yet, but we do know that there are certain infectious diseases, certain infections that are associated with lymphomas. One of the most common type is the EB virus infection. EB virus is the same virus that causes mononucleosis. We know that it is involved in the development of certain types of lymphomas, non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, and also in as many as 30 or 40% of patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma may have EB virus that we find either as a causative agent or perhaps carried along and may be part of the pathology of the disease. So we've learned a lot about the lymphomas by studying some of these viruses. We also know that there are other types of infections that have been associated with lymphoma. One of the most common is the bacteria called H. pylori, which is the same bacteria that's found in the stomach that causes ulcers. We know that in certain percentage of patients who have lymphoma involving the stomach, H. pylori is present, and in a certain percentage of those patients, we can actually treat the lymphoma by simply giving antibiotics and treating that infection. There are data which suggest that there is an association of other types of lymphomas with other infections. So H. pylori is one. There are eye lymphomas that are associated with certain bacterias. There are intestinal lymphomas that are associated with certain bacterias. And we know that there is an association of hepatitis C and certain types of lymphomas as well. So that's an important consideration. The other important consideration, I think, especially in the low-grade lymphomas, is understanding what we call the grade. So we've talked about the stage. That refers to the anatomic location. We also talk about the grade of especially the low-grade lymphomas. And there can be as many as four different grades, grade 1, grade 2, grade 3A, and grade 3B. And it's important only as sort of a guideline, I think, for clinical trials. And also, we begin to understand that patients with grade 1 and grade 2 follicular lymphoma behave perhaps in a little bit less aggressive way, whereas patients with grade 3A and 3B behave in a little bit more aggressive way. And the grade is determined by the number of large cells that you see under the microscope in a lymph node biopsy. And the way that lymphoma is diagnosed is with a removal or a sampling of a lymph node, and you look under the microscope, and one is able then to make a diagnosis. It's important, I think, to stress that in most circumstances, it's important to get a biopsy rather than a needle aspirate in terms of trying to make an accurate diagnosis of lymphoma. So the grading is important, and that's different from the staging. There have been a number of important advances in the treatment of the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and none has been as important as the recognition that there is a protein on the surface of the cell called CD20. That protein was identified many years ago. It's expressed in probably 90% of human B-cell lymphomas. And it has it's stuck to the outer surface of the cell, and it doesn't move. It seems to stay there. It doesn't disappear after treatment. So it becomes what we call an excellent target. And it turns out that that target was recognized, and an antibody has been developed to that target. That antibody is, as many of you have probably heard already, Rituxan or rituximab, and that antibody was developed as a specific in response to that specific CD20 target on the surface of the lymphoma cell. And the development of rituximab and the treatment of both the low-grade and the high-grade lymphomas has really changed, we think, the natural history of this disease and has led us to talk more and more about potential cures for all of the lymphoma. And we've known there's been a lot of research done on rituximab and either used as a single treatment, as a single agent for low-grade lymphomas, and also in combination with chemotherapy in both low-grade and in high-grade lymphomas. Recognizing that CD20 has led people to do research to identify other targets on the surface of the cell, and there are many of them. There's something called CD22, something called CD80. There's a whole host of numbers attached to those targets on the surface of the cell. And a lot of the research that's going on now is trying to develop new ways to target these proteins on the surface of the lymphoma cell and try to use combinations of antibodies against these targets. So I think this is where a lot of the research in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is going, and there's certainly suggestions that when you combine antibodies to treat lymphomas, the results are better. The other important piece of research has been the development of something called radioimmunotherapy as a way of treatment of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Radioimmunotherapy is simply taking the same antibody, the Rituxan that we've been talking about, and then adding on to that or linking that to a radioactive compound, either radioactive iodine, resulting in a substance called Bexxar, or radioactive yttrium, resulting in a substance called Zevalin. And both Bexxar and Zevalin are now available and approved for use in the treatment of the low-grade lymphomas, and they're also being studied in the treatment of the higher-grade lymphomas. So it was research, basic research, that led to the development of these treatments. In addition, there's been a lot of research trying to develop a vaccine. And many of you have heard about vaccine therapy for lymphomas. That's been an ongoing area of interest, ongoing area of research, maybe for the past 15 or 20 years. And in that setting, what's done is the vaccine is made directly from the tumor cells from a patient's own tumor, and that tumor, that vaccine is given back to the individual patient. So whereas Rituxan is more generic, it, there's the same molecule, treats everybody, a vaccine is very patient-specific. So far, there have been lots of trials with vaccine therapy. There is one study that turns out to be very suggestive that it may improve outcome in patients with low-grade lymphomas, and that observation is now being developed in with the hope of future clinical trials. There are no active clinical trials at this moment of vaccine therapy until this whole process begins to be refined. So let's talk a little bit about how we manage both low-grade lymphoma and the aggressive lymphomas. We'll start with the low-grade lymphomas. There are really three general approaches. If the disease is localized, maybe stage one or possibly stage two low-grade lymphoma, and that's only maybe in 10 to 20% of patients, but if the disease is truly localized, we would probably favor local radiation just given to that one site, and we know that we have very good outcomes when that's done. If the disease is advanced, say involving the bone marrow or many sites, based on physical exam or based on CAT scan or bone marrow biopsy, but the patients are not having any symptoms, our general approach has been to observe, because we have no data that suggests that early treatment for somebody with no symptoms but has low-grade lymphoma offers any advantage. So we've been able to observe patients for 15 years sometimes. On average, it's probably anywhere from 4 to 6 years. If you take the median, that's how long we can observe patients with low-grade lymphoma. But that means some patients need treatment within a month, within a year or two. Some may not need it for 15 years. Patients with advanced disease but are having symptoms, such as fever or weight loss or night sweats, need treatment, and then we have a whole host of treatments that we may be able to use. I would say in 2010, almost all the treatments would include the Rituxan that I talked about, either alone or in combination with a variety of chemotherapy drugs. In Europe, there's still data to suggest that interferon may be have an advantage. It's not used as much in the U.S., but it is still used in Europe. I would mention that transplantation, bone marrow transplantation, is a possible treatment, but I would not use that as an early treatment for the low-grade lymphomas, but it is a possibility for later on if the disease recurs. How do you predict if someone is going to do well? Well, there's a variety of ways to do that in the low-grade lymphomas. One of those is to look at a variety of factors in the patient, such as how many lymph node sites are involved, and whether there's anemia or not. So a physician can tell, an oncologist can tell, based on those signs, whether someone may need treatment early or may not need treatment. There's also some research that's been done suggesting that if there are lots of immune cells or T cells in the biopsy, that would suggest someone's going to do better. But if there are a very few number of those T cells present in the biopsy, research suggests that patients may not do as well. And so that's another area to begin to look at in low-grade lymphomas to try and predict how somebody's going to do. As far as the aggressive lymphomas go, the diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, this is a disease that's most common starting in the 50s and 60s, although we do see younger patients with this disease. This is an aggressive disease, and our approach is to do treatment early on, fairly aggressive treatment with chemotherapy and with Rituxan. How do we predict if someone's going to do well or not? There are a variety of factors that include the age and whether there are symptoms or not, and a blood test called the LDH level that help us predict how somebody's going to do. But we also have learned through research that there are molecular ways. There are ways to look at the DNA to help us predict whether someone's going to do well or not. And those are being studied in a variety of research trials now. It's not something that's used, the molecular analysis is not something that's used routinely yet. We know that from a variety of studies around the world that Combination of Rituxan with aggressive chemotherapy is the standard of care. So Rituxan and CHOP for most patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma offers the best approach to treatment. I'm going to spend about 2 minutes, and then I'll stop, talking about Hodgkin's lymphoma. Hodgkin's lymphoma makes up, as I said, a small proportion of the total number of lymphoma cases, but it's much more common in younger patients, patients in their 20s and 30s. What I can say is that there's been tremendous progress based on basic research, studying patients from the 1960s all the way through the 1990s, and we know that the outcome has been dramatically improved and that most patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma are cured. We've studied ways of using combined chemotherapy and radiation, and we've learned that we can reduce the radiation field in patients with Hodgkin's disease, and there are some studies suggesting we may not even need radiation for many patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma. The other major advance has come in understanding the way to assess response. We've used CAT scans, but now we've been using PET scans, both for Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and we're learning that an early response by PET scan is a very good predictor of outcome in patients both with Hodgkin's lymphoma and with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So what I'd say in closing is tremendous progress based on both basic research, understanding the disease, and also on clinical trials, which have allowed us to use the results that we get in the laboratory and apply them to patients. And that's what Dr. Pagel is going to talk to you about, is many of the new trials that were presented not only at this most recent ASCO meeting, but at similar meetings in the past year or so. So I'll close here and turn this over to Dr. Messner again.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gordon, for an outstanding, really, overview and presentation. Very informative. I really can't thank you enough. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. John Pagel. Dr. Pagel is Associate Member, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Assistant Professor, Medical Oncology Division, UW Medicine, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Pagel is going to address clinical trials, the new research findings presented at ASCO, and disease-specific treatment updates. I now turn this program over to Dr. Pagel.
Great. Thank you, Carolyn. It's an absolute pleasure to be here with everybody on the phone and have a chance to talk a little about the big picture of clinical trials and a little bit about what's happened at the recent ASCO meeting and address some disease-specific updates as well, if we have in the next, let's say, 10 minutes or so. Actually, maybe before I get started, I'll tell everybody that I'm sitting in Seattle today looking out my window, and a quarter mile away from my window is a Space Needle, and that's a big deal for us here because usually I can't see the Space Needle, but it's clear today. In fact, today we may even hit 80 or so degrees, which is a major accomplishment for us, first day of summer here. Well, let's get started. What I want to do mostly is just give a little bit of a big picture about clinical trials. Dr. Gordon did an absolutely wonderful job leading in to the idea of development of clinical trials and why they're important. And I want to take off from there and continue that discussion. Remember, clinical trials in oncology are not typically what we would call insignificant for the reason that patients who enter in clinical trials have cancer, and they want a major benefit if they can get that from their treatment. So clinical trials in oncology typically focus on important outcomes, important goals for patients, not just determining if we can actually make an improvement of a minor proportion. Many times these clinical trials are really trying to make major improvements in significant manner, in particular in the natural history of the disease, and actually helping people to keep their disease away longer or hopefully even live longer and really work towards curing these diseases. That's really what the goal of clinical trials are in lymphoma therapy for the most part. I just want to back up for a minute and give you an idea how clinical trials work. Clinical trials, of course, come from years of laboratory research in general. They are born out of a hypothesis that seems reasonable and important, and I want to stress the word important. Lymphoma researchers are clearly trying to develop important therapies that help people today. So that hypothesis is put through a series of laboratory studies, first perhaps at the bench side. In vitro is what we would call in the test tube, seeing if a agent a new drug, perhaps as an example, might kill lymphoma cells in the test tube. If that looks promising, then it's, of course, taken to a more clinically relevant situation by putting that type of agent into animals, something we would call in vitro studies, or sometimes they're called preclinical studies, and those might be small animals or large animals, but very important studies that really set the groundwork for establishing the activity of a drug before it gets to patient use. These drugs, once they get to clinical trials, have promise. And that's important to say. These drugs, when they get to clinical use, have not just been blindly picked off the shelf. They have promise because they've been looked at in the laboratory, looked at in other systems prior to coming to a clinical trial for human use. What do clinical trials look like then for humans? Well, there is, you've probably heard that they might be broken down into different phases, something we call phase 1, phase 2, 3, and sometimes phase 4 trials. I just want to briefly touch on each of those phases of a clinical trial because I think it's very important to understand what they are. Phase 1 trial is the first step. The first thing you want to know about a drug is if it's safe to use. Phase 1 trial is establishing then the safety of a drug and establishing the best dose of the drug that is safe. It doesn't make sense to have any drug that might help somebody if it also hurts them more than it helps them. So we have to make sure that drugs are safe to use, and that's what a phase 1 trial does. I want to point out importantly, however, though, despite the fact that our endpoint or what we're looking at is safety in a phase 1 trial, we're absolutely trying to help patients in a phase 1 trial. Certainly those drugs have potential benefit, even though it's a what we call an early trial or a phase 1 trial. I think perhaps one of the most important things I can say today is that these trials are based on populations of people, but there's no reason that someone might not have a specific benefit, a major benefit, despite the fact that they're enrolled in a phase 1 trial. Phase 2 trials are then the evolution of taking that drug to really establish in a larger patient population that the drug works, that it helps people, that maybe it helps people live longer, maybe it helps people from ever keeping their disease from coming back. And certainly there are trials in lymphoma that are trying to achieve those kinds of goals. Phase 3 trial then definitively determines if a drug works or not. In general, those are what we call randomized studies. Now, phase 3 trials are rarely randomized, in fact, almost never in oncology, to something that will not benefit. So a lot of people will always be concerned that they might be getting a placebo or something that they may that may not help them. That would really essentially be unethical in treatment of cancer patients. We have to give you at least a standard of care or something that has a potential to be significantly beneficial, and then compare the drug in the study to that standard of care or something, again, that would be known to be beneficial for patients. If something looks good that in a phase 3 trial, then that is commonly what is used for approval of a drug by the Food and Drug Administration. So drugs that you might get at your local oncologist have all been through this kind of process, phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3. And once drugs are approved, they may then go into a variety of what we call phase 4 studies. Sometimes you might hear the term post-marketing studies. Those are really now expanding the use of the drug and, of course, continuing to show, importantly, that the drug works, helps people, and redefine its use. These are the phases of a clinical trial, and I think the most important thing to know is that clinical trials, again, can help patients. If you can participate in a clinical trial, you have the opportunity, perhaps, to get the next new and better agent that might have significant benefit depending on what your goals might be. So some patients might be a little bit younger, and their goal might be to be a little bit more aggressive, and they might look for a trial that might be perhaps more aggressive in its approach, more combinations of therapy, longer durations of treatment, perhaps maintenance therapies. At the other end of the spectrum, maybe you might want to participate in a more, let's say, conservative clinical trial. Maybe you're thinking of something that might be an oral agent, something easy to tolerate that will keep your disease quiet for hopefully a long period of time. Even if it never makes it completely go away, that might be okay. Hopefully you understand my points are that there are a variety of clinical trials out there that I'm sure would be right for almost every patient who has lymphoma. The biggest thing is to ask your doctor, your oncologist, about your clinical trial options. Do some research on the internet about clinical trial options. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is an outstanding resource for getting you plugged into clinical trial options. There's a phenomenal website known as clinicaltrials.gov, which I would encourage everybody to explore. Not every clinical trial is right for everyone, clearly. We know that. However, there are important clinical trials that have significant benefit for you today if you were interested in that kind of approach. Because of clinical trials, we now have advanced our field dramatically. Dr. Gordon pointed out that, as an example, rituximab has changed really the natural history of this disease. And rituximab, of course, went through these phases of clinical trials that we've discussed. Now we're asking the next questions that are very important about, let's say, rituximab or other therapies for lymphomas. We've talked about vaccines or the like. There are many remaining questions that we need to answer, and the ASCO meeting this year tried to address some of those questions. I'm going to give you the highlights of ASCO. I want to do that over the next just couple of minutes because I want to make sure that I leave a lot of time for questions, because I know with 1,200 people on the phone, we've got probably more questions than we have time for. I'm going to focus in the ASCO, from the ASCO meeting on some highlights in lymphoma therapy, breaking it down, as Dr. Gordon did, into either indolent lymphomas or aggressive lymphomas. I'm just going to give some highlights first about the indolent lymphomas, and the first trial I want to let you know about from ASCO was the trial known as the PRIMA study. The data presented at ASCO from the PRIMA study was long-awaited and very important. We've known in the past that rituximab has a role in combination of improving outcomes for patients when it's combined with chemotherapy up front. We've recently learned that if it's given as a maintenance approach in the upfront setting after just chemotherapy alone, that it has a significant benefit. We also know that it works in a very positive way in the relapse setting as well, both upfront combinations with chemotherapy as well as maintenance therapy. The PRIMA study took it then just a little bit further and asked the question, if rituximab in the combination with chemotherapy up front and the use of maintenance rituximab for 2 years after completing the chemotherapy and induction Rituxan would have a benefit or not for patients. The PRIMA study was conducted in that way where patients would get chemotherapy with rituximab, and then they were randomized to get either maintenance rituximab over 2 years or just continue to be observed without any further ongoing therapy. And the PRIMA study really demonstrated that 2 years of rituximab maintenance therapy after the induction chemoimmunotherapy for these patients who had previously never been treated had a major significant improvement in outcomes for patients with little to no additional toxicities for these patients. A very important finding, something that reiterates the use of trying to improve responses by continuing ongoing maintenance therapies. In the upfront setting, another trial actually also looked at this type of approach for patients after a stem cell transplant. Dr. Gordon mentioned that transplants are typically not for patients until they've relapsed perhaps even multiple times. I concur with that thought. It's actually now been looked at in that setting in a paper presented at ASCO where patients got a stem cell transplant and then were randomized to get either ongoing maintenance rituximab or no further therapy. And again, patients had a major significant benefit with the ongoing use of rituximab with improvements in outcomes for those patients. There were a lot of new novel drugs presented at ASCO, especially in the indolent lymphoma setting. Another very promising agent is Revlimid, also known as lenalidomide. It's an oral agent that was presented to be used in combination with rituximab for patients who had untreated indolent lymphomas. The bottom line here is that in a small number of patients, this combination of the oral pill lenalidomide and the antibody rituximab produced excellent responses for patients with indolent untreated lymphomas, a very promising approach that we got to learn a lot more about, but again, well tolerated and something that we have a lot of excitement in seeing how that develops. I'll mention one other indolent lymphoma therapy presented at ASCO was now the development of a new anti-CD20 antibody called ofatumumab. Ofatumumab is an agent which has been approved for use in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Now it's being used and looked at in combinations with chemotherapies in patients with follicular lymphomas, indolent lymphomas. A study presented at ASCO looked at this agent, ofatumumab, a new anti-CD20 antibody, in combination with standard chemotherapy, in this case CHOP chemotherapy, for these patients, and really found that the combination was very well tolerated for these patients with very high response rates and effective across really all patient subgroups for patients with untreated indolent lymphomas. I'll shift gears just a brief minute just to talk about aggressive lymphomas. Because of time, I want to get to questions here in just a minute. The aggressive lymphomas were also discussed at ASCO, and I want to highlight one very interesting abstract presented there, which used radioimmunotherapy, a radio-labeled antibody, as consolidation for patients who have relapsed after for consolidation therapy in the upfront setting, as well as for relapse therapy for patients with aggressive lymphomas. The idea, of course, with, as Dr. Gordon mentioned, with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and aggressive lymphoma, would be hopefully to take patients to a transplant if they relapse. Many patients, however, may not be able to relapse. May not be able to get a transplant. And so we want to, of course, prevent them from relapsing. We want to try and cure them, especially if they're not going to have another option for cure with a stem cell transplant. Radiolabeled antibody actually was used as consolidation, as first-line therapy for these patients after upfront chemoimmunotherapy for their diffuse large cell lymphoma. And it was really found to be very exciting, that it had very high response rates, and looks like it has a significant chance of helping the overall survival and outcomes for patients who might not be able to get a stem cell transplant. Lastly, I want to point out another drug that's very exciting that maybe many of you heard about, was an abstract presented at ASCO using a new drug known as bendamustine in combination with rituximab for patients with relapsed or refractory large cell lymphomas. Small number of patients, but again, the data was very exciting in that it provided a new combination of regimen that's very active and well tolerated. This drug, bendamustine, has gained a lot of favor and is very exciting in that it is typically well tolerated in lots of different patients, and it has very few infusional toxicities or other side effects, including the fact that very few patients lose their hair with this drug, something that might be very appealing for patients. That's my overview of ASCO, and I think since we only have around 20 minutes or so left, Carolyn, I probably ought to turn it back to you for the questions.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Tego, for an outstanding presentation as well. Just really very informative, lots of new information, and we do have time for questions. And before we take questions, I do want to actually introduce Brian Tomlinson, who is actually responsible for today's program in many ways, both in terms of helping to plan it and to help seek funding for it. And he is Director of Programs and Services, Lymphoma Research Foundation. And he will say a few words to you about the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Brian?
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you once again to Cancer Care for just a fantastic partnership and a wonderful call and a great collaboration over the years. The Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care have partnered together for our teleconference programs for years in order to best meet the needs of people affected by lymphoma. I'd also like to thank our very esteemed faculty experts, Dr. Leo Gordon and Dr. John Pagel, for taking time to be with us today, as well as for all that they do for the Lymphoma Research Foundation and, most importantly, for people affected by lymphoma. And lastly, I'd like to acknowledge the sponsors of today's program, Cephalon Oncology, Genentech Bio-Oncology, Biogen IDEC, and Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, for supporting today's call. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest lymphoma-focused nonprofit organization devoted exclusively to funding lymphoma research and providing the lymphoma community with timely information on the disease. Our mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. Our scientific advisory board is comprised of the world's leading lymphoma researchers and oncologists. This board formulates the foundation's research portfolio, seeking out the most innovative and promising lymphoma research projects to support. Under the direction of our scientific advisory board, the foundation has funded over $40 million in lymphoma-specific research. In addition to funding research, the foundation provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for all of you on the phone and for all people affected with lymphoma and their loved ones. Some of these programs and services include our Lymphoma Helpline, which is staffed by professional public health and mental health staff members to assist you in your search for information about lymphoma and appropriate resources. a clinical trials information service that Dr. Pagel mentioned earlier, where a member of our helpline team can assist you in your search for clinical trials. A lymphoma support network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experience. A broad variety of publications and newsletters that include our comprehensive disease booklets for non-Hodgkin lymphoma, Hodgkin lymphoma, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and understanding childhood non-Hodgkin lymphomas. Close to 20 disease-specific fact sheets, as well as informational e-newsletters. The Foundation sponsors a variety of webcasts and podcasts throughout the year that are available free of charge on our website and provide information on specific types of lymphoma, treatment options, and support topics. We currently have over 80 of these presentations currently available on our website. And lastly, the Foundation sponsors in-person patient conferences on the regional and national level. Some upcoming program dates include a conference in San Francisco from September 24th through the 26th, in Minneapolis, Minnesota on October 16th, and in New York on November 6th. For more information about these or any of the programs that the Foundation provides, please contact a member of our helpline team by calling 800-500-9976, or you can visit us online at lymphoma.org. Thank you again to Carolyn, Cancer Care, our speakers, and the sponsors of today's program.
Thank you very much, Brian. And now we do have time for questions. We have so much time for questions. I'm going to ask Melina to explain to you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Melina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Ron R.
Hello.
Hello, Ron. Your question?
I was wondering if there's any standard definition of cure for indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. With solid tumors and other types of diseases like colorectal, 5 years might be sufficient to say probably you're cured. I'm thinking that that's not necessarily true for indolent lymphomas, and I'm wondering if there's any other standards that are looked at to consider whether disease is cured rather than simply time.
Well, thank you very much, Ron, for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Gordon if you would address that question, please.
Yeah, so I think it's a good question, and it's a difficult one. Cures are generally defined, well, basically it's no recurrence of the disease in one's lifetime. And so it becomes really a statistical definition, and the 5 years that you hear for solid tumors are really based on statistics that suggest that after a certain time period, the chances of recurrence are very small. So in the aggressive lymphomas, we talk about 2 years as being a time where it's less likely the disease is going to recur, and as you go beyond that, it's less and less likely. In the follicular lymphomas, low-grade lymphomas, since you can get recurrences, you know, longer than that, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years even, sometimes, it's harder to define that. So there isn't yet a standard definition for cure in the indolent lymphomas. In the bone marrow transplant setting, where we expect to see cures in the indolent lymphomas, usually when the disease doesn't recur within about 2 to 3 years, we think about cures in that setting. So we start to apply the aggressive lymphoma definitions. So excellent question. I don't know that I have a time period answer for you that I can give you that says there's a cure.
And can you comment just on quality of life, Dr. Gordon, in terms of...
Right. So actually, if you look at, I think, the definitions in dictionaries, people talk about cure as either improvement or restoration of quality of life back to normal again. And so in patients who are, for example, maybe have no obvious disease and are living normal lives, perhaps we can think about cures as in that setting, knowing that there may always be a chance of recurrence, but in effect you've achieved a cure because you've restored that person to normal health based on symptoms. So that's another
way, Ron,
to look at it.
Okay, thank you. I hope that helps, Ron. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Amy D.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Amy. Your question?
Yes. What treatment options are available for a patient who has Hodgkin's disease for 10 years and have exhausted all the traditional chemotherapy protocols? Is there antibody therapy for Hodgkin's disease, radioimmunotherapy? I've been unable to find clinical trials, and I don't know which direction to go in now.
Okay. And thank you for the excellent question. Dr. Pagel, could you address that question?
Yeah. I take it this is a tough situation, and we typically approach the Hodgkin lymphoma, as Dr. Gordon pointed out, in the upfront setting of working to cure people with standard chemotherapy regimens. Patients often will then progress to a stem cell transplant or a bone marrow transplant if their diseases come back. And because patients are commonly cured with a lot of those types of approaches that I just mentioned, research has been somewhat limited in the small number because of the small number of patients who have relapsed after autologous transplants or stem cell transplants. There's certainly a need there. There is one very exciting agent out there that I would mention, which is only obtained through clinical trials, which is now available or will continue to be available in the near future, which is an antibody that targets the CD30 antigen on the surface of Hodgkin lymphoma cells. That antigen actually is widely expressed on Hodgkin lymphoma, and the antibody is known as SGN35. It's an antibody that has a drug attached to it known as auristatin, perhaps the most important interesting agent out there. Many other agents are being looked at in early stage trials, and again, I think this is where if you look at the clinicaltrials.gov or Lymphoma Research Foundation resources, you'll be able to find other sources of trials.
So, Amy, thank you for that excellent question. And your question is one that certainly in terms of accessing clinical trials, do contact the National Cancer Institute there and, of course, the Lymphoma Research Foundation. They would be able to help you with trials that are available for you. And thank you so much for your excellent question. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Donald M.
Yes, thank you very much. I unfortunately, after 10 years of indolent lymphoma, developed prostate cancer. For that, I'm taking Lupron and finasteride. And my question is, since these two drugs deplete your body, have a lot of side effects, is there some possibility that my long vacation from lymphoma comes from, it is now coming back in the glands in my neck and chest and hip. And all of a sudden, I wonder if there's some study that would tell whether these drugs would increase the chance of the lymphoma coming back.
Donald, that's an excellent question. There are probably many people on the call with a question similar to yours. I'm going to ask Dr. Gordon to address that.
No evidence, at least off the top, that I can think of that would make you think that that either Lupron or finasteride might increase the growth rate of lymphoma cells, at least certainly not to my knowledge. So I think the answer is no. I mean, it is possible that the lymphoma is coming back just because it's been a certain period of time, it's been 10 years, and but you still should be able to respond to treatments for lymphoma in the same way, I would think. So I don't think there would be any downside to taking those drugs as well.
Okay, thank you. Our next question, then?
Our next question comes from Avelda S.
Yes, my question is that I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 2000, and for 1 year I was on chlorambucil, and then I was in remission for 5 years, but it came back in 2006, and then I went on CHOP and Rituxan, and then after a while Treanda. It's come back several times, and now my last CAT scan and PET scan show a massive increase in my lymph nodes in the stomach. And you mentioned the HP agglura, and I wondered if maybe because I have so many cramps and pains in my stomach that I could have an infection there. Might that help me? Because I also seem to have bloating in the stomach, too, and I'm a fairly small person. And I will be starting Trianda again, July 19th and 20th, Monday and Tuesday, and then off 28 days, and then another session.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that question. Dr. Gordon, would you like to address that?
Well, so the question is whether H. pylori could be playing a role in some of the symptoms you're having. And certainly you can see H. pylori in many settings. People without lymphoma get H. pylori infections, and they get gastric or duodenal ulcers. And it's possible that you could have H. pylori. The setting that I was describing earlier was H. pylori directly leading to lymphoma in the stomach itself. And so if we're seeing areas of lymphoma recurrence elsewhere, it's unlikely that that's related to H. pylori. But I think if you've got some stomach symptoms, it's certainly reasonable to think that H. pylori could be contributing to those if it's not directly related to the lymphoma. So, yes, H. pylori is possible, but as a cause for all the things that are going on now, that's probably unlikely.
Okay, thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Tony G.
Yes, I got a question here on the antibodies and stuff. With CD20, they attach the radioactive molecule and, you know, make it into like Zeppelin and stuff. And I'm in my sixth clinical trial, and I'm in a clinical trial where they've taken a CD22 antibody and attached like calicomycin to it. It's kind of a something that helps go after the cells. And I was told by the doctors there that this is kind of a new, possibly a new approach with the antibodies, is to attach other molecules. So that's what I was wondering. Have you heard a lot of information on are there a lot of new trials out there for attaching other things to antibodies to see what results they can get?
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Excellent question. Dr. Pagel?
Yeah, Tony, this is a great question, and this is years of research that goes into a question like this. And the short answer to your question is yes, there's a lot of interesting new agents being developed in this fashion. Really, antibodies can be developed as a biological vehicle that can deliver a payload directly to the site of the cancer cell or the lymphoma cell. That's what a radiolabeled antibody would be then. The antibody is then kind of like that biological vehicle that drives through the bloodstream looking for, let's say, the CD20 parking spot on the surface of the lymphoma cell. And the radiation might be, let's say, in the trunk of the car, and that's the smart bomb that then is delivered directly to the sites of disease. Perhaps that's in the marrow or in the lymph node. And just like you can attach radiation to an antibody, you can certainly attach perhaps lots of different things to antibodies, maybe chemotherapy-like drugs or other drugs. The drug actually that I mentioned earlier for the Hodgkin lymphoma question and relapse that targeted the CD30 antigen is that type of agent. It's what we call an antibody-drug conjugate. That's actually also being looked at targeting other antigens for patients with indolent non-Hodgkin lymphomas and also in some aggressive lymphomas as well besides Hodgkin lymphoma. The agent you mentioned, calicomycin, is a drug that we know actually will intercalate into the DNA and interrupt the machinery of a cell and kill the cell. So targeting perhaps an antigen like CD22, which will allow an antibody to internalize into the cell and deliver that drug directly to the DNA of the cell and kill the cell, makes a lot of sense. There are lots of agents out there combining drugs with antibodies or other small molecules that we know also will interrupt the DNA or the machinery, the molecular mechanisms that actually make a cancer cell persist and continue to grow. So there's a lot of smart research that's being done and a lot of early phase clinical trials that are doing that. And I, again, would encourage you to look for those.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you, really. This has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of you, first of all, our speakers who've just been outstanding. I again want to thank Brian and the Lymphoma Research Foundation. I want to thank all of you who asked such really terrific questions. You're a great audience and really asked such wonderful questions. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening. I want to remind all of you this is a one-hour education program, and that when we plan a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So although the program is soon to end, the services that you can access the questions that you may have that you still haven't had a chance to ask, the concerns that you may have, the concerns that we heard in some of your voices as you asked questions. Help with that is continuous from the Lymphoma Research Foundation and from Cancer Care. And I would like to say a word just about Cancer Care in terms of our services. We have 60 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and they are here to provide a host of services to you, from counseling and support to support groups to workshops like this to educational materials, and to really be that helping ear to help you to kind of think through issues or questions you may have. And the Lymphoma Research Foundation is a terrific resource. They have very specific information about all different types of lymphoma. They have expertise there to answer questions that you may have. I know some of you did not get to ask your questions today, and they are a wonderful resource in terms of your specific questions around lymphoma issues. So most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want you to feel alone. I want you to feel that you're part of a community of support and that we are all here to help you. And I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.